Anne Marshall. Can you talk about when you were born and where you were born and whether you were from British Columbia or another place in Canada and why you ended up living in Vancouver?
I was born in Saskatchewan, in Regina, 1907, and came from a working family. We weren't well off, but we had a large family in those days. And I was always interested in doing for people, even as a kid. It was always said at home that, oh, you'll do it for them, but you don't do it around here, you know. So, as I said, I was always interested in that way. But, it was just family trouble. Father dying early during 1918, and then the stepfather came into the picture and one thing. So I left early. I left when I was 14. And I stayed around for a while, and then one of my sisters decided to come out here, so I came with her. Yeah. And it was hard to get a job. I wasn't very big, and I looked younger than I was. And I worked in some pretty sleazy places, but at least it was work, you know. And there is where I saw, exactly at that time, there was a big longshoreman strike on. And that was when I first heard the word scab. And the first time I ever knew that there could be conflict between working people. That's where I noticed. And it was in a Chinese restaurant on Main Street. It's not there anymore. And policemen used to walk me up to the bus, a streetcar, because I used to work late at night because that's all I could get. But anyways, they were good to me. And the longshoreman gave me the first insight. That's when I first got interested, and I was about 19 then, I guess.
Which strike was that?
Oh, I can't remember. That'd be about 24.
Right, yeah.
Around 24. It was a nasty strike. And that was the first time, as I said, I heard the word scab. And they told me, that some of them, when I was serving them, said, it's the first time I ever knew you would associate with scabs, working as a working person. And I didn't even know what they meant, you know, till I inquired, what did scab mean? And that. But anyways, as I said, I worked around at odd jobs. And then I got a babysat for a Mr. Rafel that used to own Sweet 16, but it was called Rafel's up on Granville. And then as the children got a bit older, and I'd been there about 3 years, I guess, with them, he asked me if I'd like to learn to sew. I said, sure. So that's where I first got interested in sewing. That would be about 1925.
And so you had your first job in
A ladies' ready-to-wear it was. He had the store in the front, and he made special orders in the back if they wanted, or he made stock also, if you know what I mean.
So it was almost like a small shop where all the work was done in.
Yes, that's right.
And those places were all non-union.
Oh yes, there wasn't any union garment unions at that time here in Vancouver. And then of course I got married in 28. I worked in garment shops right up till 28. No, not even then. I can't recall the union being very active in 28, because I worked at Standard Garments. And so then I got married and I stayed home till the children were 7 or 8, and the war, then during the war.
So you began to work again during World War II?
That's right, yeah.
And was that when there was unionization?
In the meantime that I had been home, I think it was Fitwell Garments and Reliable, and a few shops had been organized. And then I went to work at Janssen's. And this is the first time, I never worked in a shop with piecework. That's like you do one operation and you get so much for that operation. But in Janssen, that was the first I'd ever seen this business of you had to put a zipper in 2 seconds or something like this, you know what I mean? It's not a little exaggerated, but and at that time, they had a system in there that was called a Badeau system. It came from France, In fact, I think somebody said later on, after years, few years, that someone murdered him because he introduced this system, is that the price was set by the company, they timed you, and if you didn't make your pay, you just got what you made. But if you made over your pay, like say I was to make 50 cents an hour, and that time it was about 25 cents an hour, but let's say if I was to make 25 cents an hour, I just got, and I didn't make 25 cents an hour, I just got 25, the bare minimum. And, but if for 3 or 4 days I made 50 cents an hour, they didn't give me 50 cents an hour. They averaged my pay out so I came out to like what I could get above 25 cents. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
You didn't get, like I didn't get one day, I didn't get paid for 8 hours at 50 cents. I got paid at 8 hours at an average, which they took off my 50 cents an hour to make up where I hadn't made my pay the 2 days before. This is how it was worked. And of course, naturally, I got thinking about it, you know, and I thought, God, that's a miserable way to... By this time, I'm married, and I got the experience of being in the world, if you know what I mean. And I thought, that's sort of something, isn't it, now? So I talked to some, and my girlfriend, that even before I was married, worked there, and had worked there for a long time. And I said to her, I says, this is crummy. I says, my gosh, you work hard as you can work, and you don't make your pay, and then when you make it, they take it away from you. And they used to show it every day on the board. You could see the 100 girls and boys working, men working there, could see exactly what you made and when you didn't make it. You were in the red and you were in the black. And they were posted every day, every day. So anyways, we got laid off. It got slack and we got laid off, and I went to work in the detention home. First I went to work in another crummy place, a uniform place. She was really cheap. And then I got a chance to work as a matron in the detention home. So I worked there, and while I was working there, they put on a drive for unionizing. So I was called back to Janssen then when it got busy, and in the meantime, they had spoke to me about Rurley Gervin. He used to be head of the council here. And he said, Ann, how about organizing Janssen's? I said, oh, I couldn't do that. I says, I can't talk to people like that. He says, well, you're there, you see. So anyways, I said, well, I'll try. It's all I can do. Because I was a married woman, and my husband was working, so to be fired didn't mean anything to me. And see? And I tell you, in those days, we had younger girls like that were on their own. This is what burnt me up. They were on their own. And they couldn't make their pay. And when we'd clip our coupons, my girlfriend that was married and her husband was working, and I, and one or two others, we used to give them some of our tickets so they could keep their pay up.
Were many of the women who worked there single? And so
at that time, there were quite a few. Right. Quite a few young ones that were coming along. And that's how, that, I mean, it was just a bad situation at that time. So anyways, I got talking to them, and I talked to this one, and I talked to that one. And then they said, yes. Yeah. So then I said to Rolly, well, I have to have cards. I says, give me cards, and I'll get them signed. And just the same as you do now, you have to get a majority, you see. Mm-hmm. And of course, and I was very friendly with the boss. I was very friendly. He was a really a nice person. He really was, even to the end. He was a real gentleman. And I was quite friendly with him because he knew a lot of people I knew.
Did that help you to organize?
No. Oh, no. Oh, no. He didn't like it at all. When he found out I was organizing, it still didn't really affect our friendship, but it wasn't there, if you know what I mean. The coolness was there. And, of course, I couldn't do it during working hours because they practically timed you when you went to the washroom, never mind anything else. They'd say, well, you went to the washroom 4 times and you stayed down there 10 minutes, so you're losing time. You know what I mean? Everything was time, time, time. You just had to keep your nose under the needle. So anyways, I managed it. And there was a bit of combustion for a while, but just like you said. So we went into the United Garments because we didn't know where to go. I didn't know about the other one. And, of course, as soon as they knew we were organized, they came after us to come into the ILGWU.
What was the difference between the United Garment Workers then?
The United Garment is strictly a label, if you know what I mean. They sell their label. You'll see it on, in those days it was Galt's and Campbell's and up in the GWG up in Edmonton.
Yep.
And at that time, we went in there. So then, of course, the head guy comes out from Winnipeg, Mr. Herbst. And he was looking at, he was a real organizer. He'd come from New York and from out of the trade. And he had organized a lot of the shops in Winnipeg. He had really helped them in Winnipeg. So he came and we called a meeting. And he said his little piece, you know, about why we should be with them and not with the others. We'd already paid our initiation fee into the others.
Right.
And he said, so we let him talk and that. So then he says, well, now we'll take a vote. I says, no, we won't. I says, you'll go out of the room. All of you will go out of the room, like all their executive, and that was there. A lot of their executive was there. And they were saying what they'd done in Fidwell and Reliable Garment and everything, you know. And I says, no, we won't. And of course he says, why won't we? I says, because. I says, we want to talk about it first. I says, so you all go out of the room and we'll talk about it. Well, it nearly floored him that someone would get up and tell him what to do, I think. Well, he said after. He says, I'm telling you, I just couldn't believe my ears, you know, that anybody had the nerve to get them tell you to go out, you know. I said, so anyways, they went out, and I told them now, I says, this is what it is in one, and this what it could be by the sound of it in this. And they are the better shops. They're not overalls and stuff and jeans and stuff like that, and they're not tailored garments that, like the United. I says, but I says, I feel that the ILGWU, because I had listened and read a little bit, would be maybe the stronger of the two. I said, well, I knew the other lady that ran the GWG, too, I forget her name now. And she didn't have the gist or the finesse as far as she was friendly with the bosses. That's fine to be friendly with the bosses, but you still have to have your principles set in the right direction. And so anyways, we said, and I says, no, decide now what you think. So a few got up and said what they thought and that, and I said, okay, we'll take a vote. I said, now don't be bashful about your hand, because we have no paper to make a ballot on. I said, don't be bashful. If you don't like it, just say so. Well, they were all correctly for it, you know.
Because the ILGWU offered a stronger union?
Yeah, stronger. It had more backing to it.
Were their contracts better, generally?
Oh, yes. They had done real well for the other factories and that. Because I had talked to some of them before, too. And I knew quite a few of them, because I had been in that trade previously. Before I was married, you know. Like, I knew a lot of them from years back. And I had talked to them, you know. And they were saying how much better they had been off with them. And I didn't tell that to the people. I just said that, well, from what I can understand, they are the stronger of the two. So anyways, we went, ILGWU. And we negotiated a contract with Janssen. And it was a hard one, because the management was against it, and they had a lawyer arguing. But Mr. Herbst was a very good negotiator, if you know what I mean. He
mm-hmm.
look and he could talk, and you know, he'd bring you up to think they'd think, oh, well, he's weakening, and all of a sudden he'd put a bombshell in there that would make them stop and think. So as I said, that's how I started really organizing.
When you were first approached by, was it
Rolly Gervin, yeah.
Yeah, who was he? And how
he
did
was
you
the
meet him?
President of the Vancouver Labor Council. I knew him from on the streetcars. My husband, at that time, 1939, my husband managed to get on the streetcars, because he had tried several times before, but always you had to bring or have a university education to drive a streetcar in those days. Oh, they didn't take, yeah, they didn't take everybody and anybody, but he had only, you know, grade 8, and he had worked in a dairy all his life, although, mind you, he drove the truck a lot in the dairy. But he delivered milk. He was just an ordinary Joe. And he managed to get on the, he'd always wanted to get on, but he never could make it because his education wasn't there. And he got on, of course, during the beginning of the war. And that's how I met Rolly Gervin. Mm. You see, he knew that Billy, and he knew that I was working at Janssen, so that's why they approached me.
And you were pro-union at the time. You were already fairly convinced.
I had the feeling, this is a nasty way to have to work.
Right.
If you can't have a bit of a say, you know. But they used to, I'm telling you, it was, you know, a day unless you've been through that kind of system of timing. They didn't just time it. Now, today, it's a lot different. They let a girl do it, and then she says, I can do so many in an hour. Well, you can tell by her pay if she isn't honest or she is honest, you know what I mean? But there, they just, if you stop to breathe, they stop the clock, and that was a minute wasted.
So there was very heavy supervision of...
The timing?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Particularly in Janssen, they had it right down to the tenths of the second or tenth of the minute, you know. Oh, yes, they were... Well, now it's not... for years now it hasn't been nearly as bad as that, even in Janssen.
How did production work? Was it like you'd work on pieces of garments? Or?
Yeah, you put in all zippers. You get a bundle of maybe 30, 45 garments. So it all depends. And if they're... That was another thing. If you had only five garments in a bag, you were on tying, and this they time too, how long it took you to untie it and tie it up again, you know. And so if you had, say, four or five in a with five garments in a bundle, it took you longer than if you had 20 garments in one bundle, because you only opened once and tied up once, you see. But anyways, it piecework is... I'll tell you, it's good training for housework because you can time yourself. You'll get this room done in 15 minutes or you'll get that room done, and you know how long it's going to take you to get your house in shape. But gradually, then we threw out the Badeau system. That was the one thing.
Was that through negotiation?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No more of that. There would be timing, right? But no more of this. If you made 50 cents... all day today and you only made 25 cents tomorrow, you didn't lose. You got the minimum for not making your pay, and you got the 50 cents for that day that you made your pay. It was just straight. What you did, you earned. And that was all, if it was left up to you, how hard you worked, you got it. If you didn't work hard, you didn't get it. And it was honest. I mean, it's not a bad system, because production must go out, and they price their articles on production. They don't price it on because what you can do and what I can do and two things. There's no average in this, you know.
How would they determine the speed at which people should work?
Well, you say if you have to make, let's say, 60 cents an hour, well, you got to have a price on each garment or that to do to make that 60 cents. So if it took you 5 minutes to, or say 6 minutes to do at one garment, so you knew you had to make 10 garments in an hour to make that 60 cents, right?
Right.
So it made it easier for them that way, because they knew I have to get 10 out. So if you worked hard in the morning when you were rested, you could make over your pay. So if you weren't so, if you were tired in the afternoon, you still would make your pay or make your 60 cents or whatever you wanted to make, what you'd based yourself on, because you knew that you had done extra in the morning. In the afternoon, sometimes it would be hot or that, and you, you know, you couldn't produce as much. And of course, you get tired. But, it was a lot better. Oh, and than that, everybody was much happier. And the time workers didn't get too much. Even the cutting was on piecework. They got so much for cutting. Well, you know what I mean. It's always hard unless you see it or know what it is.
Did that affect the quality of the garments produced?
Not in those days, but I will say, as the years went on, it began to. It really did. And then the type of people that we got in the trade, because shipyards and other things and women working in shipyards, the money was good, so you didn't get the good people, the workers in the trade. You got people that... didn't know, for one thing, and then didn't care. It was just, oh, I'll make that much, and that's okay. Maybe, you know, some women would come in. And So if they made a few dollars, that's okay. But the quality of work suffered. This is what suffered, was piece work. But then time work, it could kill a shop, if you know what I mean, because mm-hmm. somebody would take all day to do one seam or two or three seams, you know what I mean?
In terms of productivity?
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. It would lower the productivity. And but that's what I, not only in our trade, but this, and even today, it's the same thing. There's no pride in the work, and the people don't care. All they think of, I'll get it out and get it away and get the money. And this you'll see. Just look at the garments. Just look at some of the garments, and you'll see it. But there's not the pride that we used to have back in the 20s, you know, in the 30s. There's not the pride in the work, the quality of the work. Now, there's the odd shop yet that turns out a real nice garment and that, but they're all back east. Of course, they have much better workers back east than we have out here. And that. Then and now, with there's a few of our newcomers. And then some of the newcomers that came, but a lot of our newcomers that came as displaced persons, you know, after the war, they weren't in the garment trade. They were everything else. Some were practically lawyers or dentists or chemists or something like this. But what else could they do? You see, our union went over there, and you had to be able to make a pocket or a buttonhole. And I could tell you, even today, one of them is my very best friend. His brother-in-law couldn't sew at all. So when they called the name, he went up, but because he had could sew. His dad had been a tailor, but he had been just a little boy when his dad and they were taken to the concentration camp. And but he had known enough, and his mother knew how to sew. And when his brother-in-law, and his sister was too young, when they went, she went to the concentration camp to know anything. But they all came out here as garment workers, because when they called Tony's name, Tony made the pocket. When they called Sam's name, Sam couldn't make, so Tony went up. And vice versa, the mother could sew when she got in and was able to come. The daughter didn't go up because, I mean, this I know.
Yeah.
And what, you couldn't blame them. God, no.
You needed to get into Canada.
Just to get out of that camp.
Right.
Just to get out of that camp. And that's what we got a lot of them. And then, of course, they were money hungry when they got here. And it was just a lot of them. There was still some good ones, mind you. There's always some good ones amongst the bad ones and vice versa. That you'll find, I think, in life all through. And, of course, the bosses used to yell at us and yell at me and tell me, what do you send me people like that for? And they come in the office and they say they can do it. How can I know? I haven't got a machine here and I haven't got anything here to help sew, you know, but I'm telling you, many a time I turned my own garments inside out to show them what to do when they went in, you know, like finishing, particularly hand finishers. This is the way you do it, you know, mm-hmm. so that when they went in, they would have some knowledge of what to expect, you know.
The company's hired through the union then?
Pretty well. Yeah, they could advertise. We never stopped that. And this is another thing, this thing today, them trying to get rid of the union shop. Now, we used to give people maybe 2 months. All our contracts call for was a union shop, not a closed shop, but a union shop, would maintain a union shop. And it was up to us to decide how long you could work before you would join the union. Now, those people that had gone before you had suffered to get your 8-hour day and your dollar an hour and a few other things, a nice place to eat, and, you know, different things like this, and not your nose isn't at the needle all the time. I felt that it was only fair that our people, and some of our newcomers at that time, they were the hardest to get into the union. They just felt that was wasted money, and our dues were never high.
Was this in the around 45, 46?
Yeah, around that time there. And but we always had in our contracts maintain a union shop. So that if, when they, I'd say, well, so-and-so's been there 2 or 3 months. She must be doing all right or you wouldn't have kept her, you know. So she has to come in the union now. And Jansen was particularly for a big shop. It was a big shop, you know, and still is, I would say.
How many people would work here?
Well, at the height of a season, you could have 200 or 300 in there, you know, because they had shifts. Because they have to get it out, everything out by the 24th of May. That is swim stuff out by the 24th. Sweaters are a little different. The swim stuff, it must, if it's not finished and ready and shipped by the 24th of May, it's no use sending it. So, as I say, that's what I say when their government and they're talking about getting rid of the union shop. I think it's very unfair to other people that worked to get the conditions that man's working for now. Sure, he likes the $10 an hour that a lot of them are getting today, but he didn't work for it. A lot of them didn't work for it. So why shouldn't they? And our union has a pension plan. We had a sick benefit, and we had a pension plan, and today I just asked Connie, how many is on? She said about 42 or 43 are on that. And they get a raise on their pension plan Now, the boss paid some percentage of the payroll into that pension plan. We didn't get a raise, much of a raise that year, but we did get our pension plan. And we had a health and welfare, and it was in there, you get your... Because that's one thing in that tree they used was their eyes.
Yeah.
Their eyes. So we said right away, we said, we got to have eye examination, and everybody should go, and we had to build that fund up so that 300 people could go once a year, you know. And nowadays it was only maybe $5 or something to have an eye examination. And then when the fund built up, we gave them so much towards glasses. You see, now why shouldn't you join the union? Why shouldn't you? You get those benefits, even if you don't belong. Why should you get it?
Right. And that was the principle behind it.
That was the principle behind it. So, as I said, it burns me up when I hear them say you shouldn't have a union, you shouldn't be forced to join the union. I say if you're good enough to work for that company, you should belong to the union, because the union has fought for the principles of health, welfare, and so on. Right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that is one thing that is very bad today when you hear even labor, government people saying that they shouldn't have it. Have some cereal, Dad.
Okay.
And then make some toast for yourself.
Okay. How about lead women? Did they have people on the shop floor who they used to pace the work of other people?
You mean the company?
Yeah.
Some, there would be, so like what we call the forelady.
Right.
Or the foreman and forelady, either one, that could be either one. We've had lots of good women and lots of good men. But the foreman was supposed to be capable of showing you how to do the job. And then when you had worked on a certain length of time, then you would be timed maybe, or they'd say to you, what price do you need, you know? And you'll say, well, I can do 10 an hour, so...
Yeah.
How much it would be, whatever the price would be.
Was it competitive on the shop floor?
Oh, yes.
Right.
You mean the foreman and the...
With
or the foreman
worker? And the workers.
Not with the foreman and the workers. Just amongst the workers themselves, it was competitive. Well, that made it good, because that's production, you see. But it isn't competitive when they do a bad job. You see, this is what I'm getting at. It's the same way you see them working on the street here. I watch, and my God takes them, lift the dirt and they throw it. Get in and get it done, you know. Now, shut that off for a minute, and I'll just tell you something. And when the garment was finished, and the samples were finished, well, then the union and the boss company would sit down and we'd get a price, and then that price would be set for that garment. Yeah, but we both worked together on that. We never always agreed, and sometimes we had to give, sometimes he had to give.
So you'd negotiate each
garment? That's right. Each garment was a price, and each operation, if it was a operation, because we had to put down so much for collars, cuffs, body, or something, or so on. it got so that after a while I got a body for like a coat or something. You couldn't for a dress because no body's too, you know, but a body is two side seams, a pair of sleeves and a so on, you know, facings and things like that. And that simplified that a bit. But we both, company and union, used to sit down, and that was that for the season till the next samples were made. Or if they made a sample in between and they were going to try something, then they'd say, price it for us, you know.
That would really require you knowing the trade very well.
That's
it?
Right. You had to know. And you had to know approximately how fast a person could work on it or how long it would take. And, like, you know, it's all right to say, oh, well, that's just a plain pocket. But you forget that you have to sew that pocket around first before you put it on, and then it has to turn properly, like a patch pocket, you know, and things like this. And it's a lot of...
So would you make each new garment? Would you go through the...
Yeah, the whole line, yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Right, so that you could...
And every day, if they changed anything, every day we had to set a different price for something new that they would come up with. They set a different price for something new that they would come up with.
And who would do that? Would that be a chairperson for the union on the shop floor?
They could, yes, but if they got stuck... Well, I generally sat in on the first bunch of samples.
Right.
And but the shop chairman could help set prices, or the finishers could set prices, like they'd go in and say, well, I think this. But a lot of the shops were never hard and fast. The companies weren't that hard and fast. If we had made a mistake, we've been able to go back and ask for more money or say, well, this here one was easier. We'd rather have less here and more here because than that.
So did that process happen outside of the contract?
Yes.
So what would the contract cover then?
It just said that, I think it used to read like, and a committee of the union and the company or the shop. No, it didn't say shop. And it's a committee from the union and that will negotiate the prices for all operations or something like that. I can't just remember how that was pricing that. And then when we got started to get paid for statutory holidays, a lot of our people were angry because I agreed with Mr. Herbst and the company that you had to be there the day before and the day after, or you didn't get paid for the statutory holiday. Unless you were sick.
What year did they come in?
The statutory holiday? Yeah. Well, each year we negotiated, we tried to get a few more until we got them all. You know, but you didn't get them all at once. We negotiated a few each time till we got them all. But in Janssen's and in the other shops, we had that... You had to be there the day before or the day after, and which I think is good, because someone, when it's a long weekend or something, they'll take off Friday, and they'll take off on Thursday because they get paid for Friday, and they're off Saturday and Sunday. You see what I mean? Mm-hmm. But mostly it was that you had to be there at least the day before. It was flexible, but if the company wanted to pay, that was one thing. But statutory holiday, you had to be there the day before and the day after, and I think that's fair.
And that would be in the contract?
That's in the contract.
What other things would be in the contract as opposed to the prices which were negotiated as they came up?
Well...
Pensions and...
Oh, yes. I really think they should be portable pensions, you know, because when I think of how nice it is that some of those were widows and some of them were women that hadn't got... Mostly for the women, but now the men are benefiting from it too, you see. Mm-hmm. They get their pension. And the women, we didn't have a 65 or anything like that. All you had to be was a member in good standing for 20 years, approximately, and that you would be 60 years old. And that was a long time ago. We had 60. Now I think it's 50 or 55, 50.
Right.
And that was a long when we first, we didn't have the money, so we couldn't have people quitting, the old timers quitting. It was unfortunate. Some of them didn't get it, you know. Because we didn't have the money and we couldn't start and pay it out because we'd never got the money. But now there's enough money that they can, it's very flexible.
Were there mostly women in the shops?
Yes, mostly women.
And were there differences between what the women did and what the men did?
No, if they would do different jobs, but each job was priced on what it was, particularly in the pressing. You see, you had a piece presser, an under presser, and then you had a presser. And you had a machine presser, and different things like that, you know. So it was a finishing press, or like he touched the garment up the last thing, and so they were all done.
Would their wages be similar to the women's, or would they be a bit higher?
No, it didn't matter. Okay. It was the job, and if you did it, it wasn't because you were a woman or that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that job paid that.
Was there like a principle of equal pay in the union?
Yes, definitely, yeah. Most definitely. Because I was working on a garment that paid me 10 cents for the operation, my husband could be working on the same garment on the same operation. He'd only get 10 cents.
Right. And did men and women work on the same shop floor?
Oh yes. Oh yes. It was really together.
Right. Okay. And also, were there? You talked a bit about one influx of immigrants coming in. Were there different ethnic groups within?
Oh. Oh, if you could only have been able to talk. Deaf and dumb people too, and that we had some good workers in them, and that. But boy, I'm telling you, do a lot of writing.
Was that a problem in terms of the?
No, it wasn't a problem. No,
learned a lot of languages.
Yeah. Oh, I wished I could have. Oh my gosh, but there were so many. I mean, it was impossible, and that. But no. What I did, I used to take and get someone that could speak Italian, and we had one or two of our newcomers that was very knowledgeable, and they could speak two or three languages, you know, like Russian and maybe German or something like this, you know, two or three different languages that the European people. And I got real friendly with quite a few of them. They were a lot of fine people that came, you know. But as I said, that was the only way we could do it. We had interpreters. We had certain ones in each shop that could listen to it in their own language and then convey it.
Were there any conflicts between workers from different ethnic groups?
Oh, a little bit sometimes, yeah. Right. Sometimes, oh yes, you get that.
So did the union intervene into that at all?
Sometimes, yes. Yeah. Almost many times I
what
had
what kind
been.
Of things would you do? Get people together? Or?
Yes, I just get them up to the office, and I just say, like one time, you know, one girl caused a big commotion, because the forelady was a newcomer, a misplaced person, but she was a very good forelady, and she knew the work, and she was very good, and she was very fair. But this one girl, her husband had been in the war or something, I don't know, or her father had or something, I don't know, and she wouldn't take orders from me. She says, I'm not taking orders from her. She tells the boss. So the boss phones me out. She says, so-and-so is causing commotion in the shop. She isn't going to take orders from Hilda. And I says, why? She says, well, she says she's not going to take orders from a foreigner and then come to this country, and she was born here and that. I says, so send her up to the office. So she came up, and I talked to her for a little while about how wrong she was in it. And she says, well, I don't care. She says, we fought the war, and then they come over here, and they take all, you know, the same old story. You've heard it 100 times. And she says, I'm not going to take orders from her. I says, you take orders from me? She says, well, that's different. I says, no, I'm an Indian. I says, how do you like that? And she says, well, she says, anyways. I says, no, it's not anyways. Either you take orders or you'll have to quit. I says, and you cannot call people names. I says, you know it. I says, it's always been our rule. You do not call people names just because they're not your type of people. You know, she was very English, you know.
Yeah.
And she said, well, I'll quit. I says, fine. So I phoned out the boss. I said, she's quitting. And see, because the boss was Jewish, and the forelady was, I don't know what she was, I can't remember, but she was a foreign. She'd come over with misplaced people from some one of those countries. And that's how I used to do it. I used to just bring them up and talk to them and just tell them, you don't do these things. That's not the way to live together.
Right.
And that was the best I could.
Were there differences in the attitudes of older and younger workers towards the work and towards the union at all? Were the younger workers...
Well, yes, we had to watch that the younger ones that had the more stamina to do and last longer, that they didn't get too short a price for the older ones. If you know what I mean? We had to watch that the older ones could still make a decent wage. Now, many a time I've had to say to an older person, well, you take the lesser job. You won't get any less pay. But, you know, some of them didn't want to take a lesser job, but they were getting too old. I mean, there was arthritis would come in for the presses. I've seen their hands like that, just like that. And some of them, the sores from sewing with their hands would just be, and they've had...
Sort of clenched up.
Yeah, it's arthritis. It's tightening up. But you know, it was hard to tell them not to keep on doing the job that they had. But to ask, what do you care? What do you care if you sweep the floor? As long as you can stay there till you get your pension. You've only got a few more years. But you know, it was hard to make them see it.
I guess it was a question of pride.
Pride, that was right. That was right.
Okay.
And then automation came in, too.
Right. I wanted to ask you about that. Yeah. What was the effect of automation?
Well, gradually, the older ones got out, and so naturally they didn't have to worry so much. It was hard for a little while, but it straightened itself out. Because, as I said, as the older ones went out, the new ones weren't brought in to fill those jobs. And therefore, it was the buttonhole and the hand finishers. There was, again, to be very few hand finishers, because if you look at anything you buy, the bottom is done up by a machine, down here is done by the machine, and they don't tack the cuffs up anymore, and things like this, and that's automation. And the buttonhole machine was a big thing. It was a big thing, because... They may even had the two kinds. They had the cloth kind and this kind, but not made like this, but a real good buttonhole. And they used to always be done by hand, and to have a coat done by hand, it was really something with a good buttonhole, you know. So there you are. The machine made the buttonholes and sewn buttons on.
So rather than laying people off, they just didn't hire.
They would train a few and train a few who was in the shop, and naturally you'd get them coming from back east and that, and they would have the training. So it gradually straightened itself out.
Who would do the training? Did the union train people?
No, the shop did. That's where today you don't see many apprentice companies have apprentice. Not many. You don't. One time it was you went to the apprentice board and you could get a job as a mechanic or a painter or something and go in as a mechanic, as an apprentice. Well, we used to give them these 2 and 3 months as an apprentice. Like you'd get, 25 cents the first month or two, then you get 40 cents or something like this, and then till you got up to the pay. By the end of 3 months, you should be able to earn the standard wage.
Right.
But we had that training period in our trade. And I remember when we were first married and that down there, and a boy came to that apprenticeships, you could go to the apprenticeship board, but I never hear apprenticeship board anymore. You never hear apprentice. Very few, very, very few. It's very hard. In fact, I have one chap I know right now, he's gone through the college for heavy duty mechanic. But do you think he can get a job as an apprentice? You know, where he's got to get the experience somewhere. And they're not training. And nobody's training. Everybody goes in at the highway. You know what happened? The shipyard, that's what killed that. They didn't train. You just went in the shipyard and you made that big money. And today I hear young ones saying, oh, they want me to sweep the floor and they want me to do this and they want me to run errands. I run errands even before I was first in the trade. Well, you had to run errands. And that, and we only got in those days. We only got $5 and $6 a week, and had to live on it.
Right.
And that, but you can't compare wages, because we got good wages in those days, even comparable to this, because liver was only 5 cents a pound. You see what I mean? So we only got maybe 30 cents an hour, but at least we had the money to buy the liver. And today it's the same thing. They get $10 and $12 an hour. But liver's $2 a pound or something. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it the people aren't any worse off today. They just
sort
think
the same.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you ever have children?
Yeah, I had 2 girls.
So did you work while you had children?
Yes. I worked on right up till they went, got working.
What did you do about childcare?
Their father worked one shift and I worked the other. And the girls, they were about 7, I think, or 8. Shirley was more than that, wasn't she? Well, let's see. Shirley was born in 29. Oh, yeah, Shirley would be 10 or 12, 11 years old. They were, well up. Right. They could manage.
Did they help you with the housework?
Oh, yes. We've never in our family never had any trouble. Never.
Right.
No trouble like that. Yeah. always had to do our share. Each one had to do their share when we were all working. And
yeah, because I know that's very hard on some people too.
Yeah.